Hi, this is Jackie Neal. I have to say a few things, so give me a second, I forgot what I gotta do. Okay, my name's Jackie Neal. Today is June 13th, 2018. I'm recording this interview in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the neighborhood of Tacony. This is for the Tacony Oral History Project. That's a working title. I'm speaking with my participant. I'm gonna pause this really quick. Is it working? Okay, there. Okay, I'm here with my participant today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So you and I, I'm just gonna kind of go straight into questions because we were starting to chat and run away off a couple topics. But the first thing I wanted to say was that you and I met at Sawtown Tavern, which is in Tacony, and I was introduced to you as the resident artist.
Yes.
So I wanted to just first ask you, what kind of artist are you?
I am not really, I don't want to put a label on it. I can just simply, I can sketch, I can draw, I can paint, I can sculpt, I can 3D modeling, I can do digital manipulation. Pretty much, but I think that's pretty much, you know, the standard nowadays. So, you know, I'm not really gonna say anything, but, you know, that's pretty much the standard nowadays for most professional amateur artists, knowing these disciplines. And
did you just say professional amateur artist?
Professional and amateur.
Oh, I thought you said professional amateur artist.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would wonder which one you prefer to do, though.
I prefer the painting.
Painting.
Yes.
When I came to Sawtown, you seemed to be painting, you were painting the bench outside.
Yes.
And I saw maybe four or five paintings inside the bar, correct?
Yes.
So is that something that you chose to do based on having this residency at the bar, or is that something that you enjoy doing like as a current focus of yours?
Well, the thing is you can't put a price on good people or a fresh set of eyes. Friend Charles, his co-owner, along with Troy, they presented me with an opportunity. They thought that would be conducive due to the nature of our relationship. And, you know, and it's just, we can do some things out here, but, you know, we're gonna need you to come in and apply yourself. How do you feel about that? It's like, I think it's amazing. Thank you for this opportunity. There are far and few between. Blessings are far and few between also, and you have to try and take advantage of it. And it's your responsibility to try and take advantage of it, because if you don't, well, you know, the universe doesn't really deal with equality or equity. Whatever goes, goes. So yes, it was, and it's been amazing. Me personally, I kind of found being an artist or having that skill set is pretty much like an albatross, maybe an anchor on a shoe.
Can you expand on that?
Well, basically, I mean, as a young kid and adolescent, I embraced art as my safe place, where, you know, things wouldn't go left or end up dealing with different personalities. Just say, if you know, if you were dealing with an abusive situation, you were gonna find a safe place, and that was my safe place. But being that that's the nature of the relationship, me and the art, I didn't realize at the time that it was about health and safety for me. It was, well, you know, after a point, it wasn't about health and safety anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Shows you how much I knew. But as far as...
Well, what do you mean by that? When you say, okay, what I understand is that you're saying that it was a place for health and safety as you were growing up, but now you're saying it's not necessarily, it's changed nature for you. Can you just tell me what that means?
The thing is like I changed, but I didn't, so that my perspective changed, but it really didn't. I didn't realize it that. It's pretty much putting blinders on to certain parts of my persona. Being that the fact that, you know, it's a tenuous relationship with art, I ran to it out of necessity. So that being said, after maybe the first week of painting, the change was immediate.
In how you felt? Or
yes.
That's awesome. Okay.
The anxiety wasn't there. You know, the flashes of certain behaviors, certain thoughts, what have you, were not as prominent. Being that, you know, I got in this relationship, you know, through trauma. So other than that, I wasn't being true to myself or anything that I come across. And they had a fresh set of eyes and they granted me that blessing.
When you say that, you mean Troy?
Troy and Charles. Yes. I don't really listen to a whole lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give them an ear, but okay. We're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, definitely. Yeah. So it's just thankful. I mean, it's just to be able to keep my faculties in order by doing this. So it's kind of like, you know, what was it called? I don't know. It's like one of those all or nothing options, absolutes or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember how it was during those spans, 2.5, 3 years without creating anything. Trying to go in here and work this day job with no emotional outlet, no psychological type of, you know, care, self-care. And that's basically what it is. And, you know, I'm just thankful.
You'll find that I'm not going to speak over you, even though, and I'll nod a lot.
It's all right.
No, just because I want your audio to be clean, yeah. You know?
I know.
So we were talking about your day job. You were just saying 2.5 to 3 years of not really having an outlet and then finally having one. But what is your day job?
I'm a behavioral health worker. I work with at-risk youth in a school setting during the school day. We're giving a caseload every day, a certain amount. Every kid has a lead clinician and a set of interventions and a psychosocial and IEP we have to follow as long, and then document it accordingly. So throughout the school day. So there's a lot of paperwork, a lot of consecutive billing. You have to find a way to do that. This is a high profile school. And, you know, basically the streets are in the school, you know, played out every day. These are 3.5, 4 foot people playing out things that we see in some of the worst neighborhoods. But at the same time, you know, the nature of most of these families in these neighborhoods, these children have no other place to be a kid but at school. So, you know, as far as safe places are very important.
Wow, that's really, really an interesting way to put it, that these kids, that's their only place that they get to play out being a kid.
Yes.
I volunteered at a school in Brooklyn. It was called Williamsburg Prep, and the prep, it didn't meant nothing. It was a public school.
Yeah.
And I volunteered in their after-school program where we created oral histories, actually.
Yes.
And I often thought about how there was a desire to extend the day so they wouldn't have to go home. And I was happy that we could provide that for them.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like the Tocconi Arts Lab is a place like that as well, which is really, I think, wonderful. You don't have to be specific if you don't feel comfortable about it, but is the school where you work, is it in Philadelphia? Is it in Center City?
Or it's in Philadelphia. It's in the Kensington section of Philadelphia. It's 2 blocks from Kensington and Allegheny. One of the, like, ground zero for our little opioid thing we got going.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's just, and you know, my charges, they have to walk past this mess. People lay down on the floor, people shooting up, people selling drugs, people fighting. People having a psychotic episode, getting naked in front of everyone and running around, the whole thing. And I'm just seeing this. And, you know, a lot of the teachers at that school don't live in that neighborhood. They don't understand the dynamics. And not even that, I don't want to come across this as wrong, but a lot of the teachers there, they're detached. I don't want to say it's the nature of the majority of population being black and brown students, but, you know, everybody has their thing. So we're not going to sit up here and TV talk this to death. It's just, I don't think that any of our personnel dealing with children in any kind of capacity in this city or region or even the state is really, really given a chance to succeed at all. So, you know.
I'm sorry, to clarify, you mean students really aren't given a chance to succeed in the Philly public school system? Or that particular school?
No, it's just the staff.
Oh, the staff.
Staff are set up to fail.
You are not the first person to say that.
Set up to fail and make money, and that's okay. You know, no one is up there for free. So that being said, you have to do the right thing. And the thing is like a lot of these folks, they're regardless of race or gender, they forget that these children are people and not pets or objects. And I just try and remind them of that, the way I deal with them. You know, people are going to do what they're going to do. But it means a lot to me because, you know, I was like that, you know. So.
Do you go in and out of feeling like that, do you think? How long have you worked there and do you go in and out of it?
I've been working there just for this particular school year. I do have like maybe 12, 13 years experience working with these kids, but after a while I switched to the adult population just because it was too much, you know. But you know, we're talking about situations where some of the families will go ahead and instruct their kid to go up here and tear this school up for a month, 2 months. We could get services put in. We get extra check in the mail.
Whoa, back up. You mean like if they go to school and misbehave, they get classified as something that allows them to get services?
Eligible for another check for the family also. So it's, you know, it's tough all over. But
that's interesting.
It's not the kids. It's the grown-ups, and you know, the grown-ups are just worried about the grown-ups, and it's amazing. So not that far-fetched, but I digress.
That's okay. I have a tendency to want to touch that too, but you're gonna obscure your audio if you touch it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you live in Tacony, correct?
I live in Tacony.
Say it again. I say it correct.
I live in Tacony.
I say Tacony wrong. How do you say it again? Say it louder.
Tacony.
Tacony.
That's the way they say it here, so it's Tacony.
It's Tacony.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I grew up in South Jersey. I'm born in Philly and all that stuff, but I moved away and I got rid of a lot of the affect, you know?
Yeah.
So, like Torsdale? It's Tarsdale, right?
Yeah. Tarsdale, Torres, something like that.
Right, yeah. I don't even know.
Water, you know.
Oh, water. I love the water one. Water. That's my favorite. I'm going to go down in history saying that I love that. I wish I could keep that one, but for whatever reason, I don't have it anymore.
Okay.
So can you give me a little bit of background about Tacony? What do you know about the neighborhood and how it's like evolved? Because I took a tour, the historical tour, which is awesome, but what do you know about it?
What I know about Tacony is located lower... the southeast corner of the northeast section of Philadelphia.
That's right, it's seen, right?
Yes, and then...
it's S-E-N-E.
It was founded around Henry Diston and Company Saw Works. They exported saws all over the world, custom made. So, that being said, they really needed a place for the factory workers. Factory workers, they had access to everything. So, not the factory, but I mean Henry Diston. So he built them houses or what have you. They come and buy their stuff, and it goes from a company store, and they built up a little community. But, you know, it's progressed, it's transformed. You know, this is one of the places that, you know, that we were instructed, you know, as a young person not to venture through, not to play around in, even as late as the early 90s.
Are you not from Tacony?
I am not from Tacony.
Where are you from?
Originally, I'm from Waterbury, Connecticut. After that, age of two, from two to maybe the age of 12, no, two to the age of 15, I lived in White Plains, New York, / Hartsdale, New York, right on the border of Central Park North.
No wonder you know where I was talking about.
Yeah, after the death of my parents within 3 years of each other.
I'm going to pause. All right, here we go.
Yeah, so I had to move from White Plains, New York to Philadelphia at the age of 15, following the death of my mother, following the death of my father within 3 years of each other, that 88 and 91. So after that, I lived with my grandmother, you know. She had my father in 1946, but she was like the only one that wanted me. I didn't get bad grades, stay out of trouble, but you know, it's just, I'm 10 years behind the next family member, which is my brother. That being said, I'm a smelly teenager in high school.
No what one has, exactly is a smelly teenager?
Teenagers are smelly. You know, it's being a teenager isn't fun, and you know it because you're a teenager, and everybody else is a teenager, and we know teenagers, and teenagers, the general consensus from the baby boomers is teenagers suck. Millennials hate kids, so yeah, teenagers still suck. I remember being a teenager, it sucked being a teenager. But outside of my personal narrative, I saw other people, it sucked for them too. So I digress, like I was saying. So yeah, other than that, they had plans of throwing me a military school or something on the other side of the family. It's like, no, wow, so much for the grieving process. So if anything, I wasn't ready. My grandparents put me into the safest space that they could. Central High School, as opposed to Germantown High School, is right down the street. I couldn't socialize, couldn't do anything. So yeah, stayed out there and did not go to class almost the entire time. Ended up with 5 Fs, but extenuating circumstances. Connie Clayton was in charge of the school board, school district at the time. He's friends with my grandfather, who worked Sergeant Arms at City Hall for about 20, 25, 30 years before retiring after that. But my grandfather was a special person anyway. He made it to the 36 Olympic trials.
Doing what?
Running the 100 sprints.
Whoa.
And they did things different back then, where it wasn't overall time. If you won your heat, and there was usually one or two or three heats, and his friend Herb Douglas, he was better than Herb Douglas, so they put him in the A group. So my grandfather got smoked by Jesse Owens, legit. And because Herb Douglas wasn't the same caliber sprinter, he went in the next group going up. He won second or first in his heat. But at the same time, his times weren't even comparable like they do now. So if anything, Herb Douglas went to the Olympics. Herb Douglas went to the 36 Olympics. My grandfather had to pack it in, go back to the factory at Westinghouse making a... big giant airplane blades. And there was an accident that happened where one of them fell and almost split his toe off his foot. And he would never be able to get back to that place again. You know? So he's pretty, but meanwhile, fast forward, in the 80s, 90s, and you know, Herb Douglas, he's the toast of the town. He's the U.S. Olympic Committee member and all this other stuff. He knows Flo-Jo. Oh, Carl Lewis, I got him on speed dial. Whole thing, pools, projection, TVs, or what have you.
So what was his full name, your grandfather?
George Carlos Van Landingham. That being said, you know, so that's who I was being raised by. And they did their best. They did excellent. Filled in a lot of gaps.
Oh, just to circle back to the original question, which was, which neighborhood were you living in that they were telling you not to come to Tacony?
Oh, Mount Airy, Germantown. Where we lived at on Cedric and Sprague Street, 241 East Cedric Street. We had Chaka Fatah across the street. No, Chaka Fatah used to live there. He used to play football with my uncle and my dad. John Chaney's son used to get in on it. His family still lives across the street, same thing. And Janie Blackwell and a couple other folks, you know.
I will take your name out of if you choose to be anonymous, but I got to tell you, I know nothing about sports.
Oh no, these are city political figures.
Oh, they are.
And
who's Chaka Fatah?
John Chaney. John Chaney.
No, not John Chaney, but Chaka Fatah.
Oh, Chaka Fatah.
Who's
that? Oh yeah, he just got locked up the other year for fraud. Yeah, I mean, he was frauding some kind of way, trying to get their money, playing those political games that only certain people can play. You know?
Okay. So I don't know anything about sports.
No, but as far as like the political criminality.
I know, even political sports on that.
There's equality, but there's no equity, so.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
You're a political criminal, you're a corrupt politician, they won't let you play their reindeer games.
I know, right?
I'm sorry. I'm wrong.
I follow, as far as like local politics, I haven't followed Philadelphia's local politics in a while.
Me neither. I can't keep up.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I live mostly in Brooklyn, actually. So I know all about that business, which goes way, way back.
Yes. Yeah, so it was Mount Airy Germantown, and basically, that's in. And
they told you not to come over here. They said don't go to this town.
Yeah, my friends.
Why?
My friends is just well.
Well, what was wrong with it?
No, I said the whole Northeast is racist.
Racist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you could get beat up, you get jumped or what have you. It's like the wives' tales for a while. Now, I know a couple people after I moved here, back in 2003, should be like almost 14, 15 years ago, something like that. So it's just like, you know, I know Mr. Stanford, you know, he's talking about, well, you know, we had a couple brush-ups back then. We were kids back in the 60s or what have you. You get in fights, you throw some people in the Delaware or what have you. Eventually, people got together and knocked it off. You know each other. You see each other every day. So
Stanford, Mr. Stanford is?
Mr. Stanford Birch. He's a resident here. Been here for, I don't know, 60 years.
And so he was like saying that he didn't recall any racism.
No, he's saying there was.
There was and no longer as of like 2000 or something?
No. There was back then, but they were, I mean, it's as far as just street violence and nonsense going on, vandalism or what have you. He said they used to confront it, deal with it, and they used to have to just deal with it in the most basic, most banal way possible. You know, just defending yourself.
Well, and you don't witness it at all currently.
Not like that. No, no. But the thing is, like, I'm not saying, I haven't seen it. Personally, I haven't experienced it. Not in any way it's going to affect me. Because, look, it's Philadelphia. People elbow each other all day. So, can't put a label on that. This is what it is. So, just try and seek out and search for something that really probably is in there. And you're not going to know if it is in there. What's the point? People are rude all the time. Now, if they're
so perfect.
Denying you home loans, you know,
yeah.
They botched your bank statement, you know, the whole thing. It's, then that's different, you know. Oh, no, this kid can't go to school here. You're crazy.
Like, well, do you notice any sort of, like, separation or divide in the neighbor, like, within Tacony?
The only separation and divide is just the same struggle in most middle-class urban neighborhoods. You know, there's two sides to these things. Really,
but visibly, is there like a
the divide?
Like a certain place that you know, like I'm trying to remember. Okay, so my family's from South Philly, and I recall that there was like one parish was Italian, and that was like one set of the neighborhood, and then another parish was Irish,
mm-hmm.
and then that you know, like the streets were kind of separated.
Yeah,
is there anything like that here? Because I know there's a large. Like, from what I understand is that it was a largely German community, and yeah. Then it evolved to Italian?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, Italian-Irish. Italian and Irish. Yeah, after I think the German thing, and then I think the rest of the folks just started trickling in.
Which is good.
Yeah, but that being said, you really don't see that much. It's a mixed bag due to economic conditions, so you know, people mm-hmm. need to take what they're gonna get. They can't be choosy out here if they're begging.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say they're begging, but you're not. You know, I mean, look, if there was a $450,000-$600,000 house on the other side of Ardmore, you know, waiting for you, maybe split level, maybe even rancher, you would take that over this? I don't know. It depends on who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't feel comfortable with those people out there. I wouldn't feel safe coming back home, going back and out every day. But this right here, I know this. I know these people.
Right. You know, frequently, my friends and I all have this conversation about how we know this. You know, mm-hmm. this is, even when I've come back and forth between here and Brooklyn, and it's like in Brooklyn, there's like this certain, Brooklyn and Manhattan and all of that, there's a certain like transient culture that happens because people are coming to Manhattan or to get a job, put it on their resume, and leave.
Yes.
So there's like a different kind of mindset. But when I come back here, I feel like that. I feel like this I know. This
yeah.
I know. And so can you tell me a little bit more about what that means? Is that like a rootedness? Like, would you ever consider moving outside of Philadelphia?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I don't want to say like it's kind of like trying to buy your freedom, but I feel like it's kind of like trying to buy your freedom. As far as I'm concerned, I never chose to come to chose to come to Philadelphia.
Mm.
I mean, granted, I was a minor, was in a position to do that, but I never chose to come here.
Where would you go if you moved?
If I was gonna move,
you said not Ardmore, right?
Oh no, I
don't even know what Ardmore's like. What is it like?
No, I mean, it's just a bunch of big houses, bunch of yards, whole bunch of sidewalks, whole bunch of streets and no sidewalks.
Kind of like on the between suburb and country kind of living? Okay, yeah.
The thing is, they're richy. And you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like maybe like a quarter mile from the fence to the door.
Okay.
So, you know, but
so where would you move?
Where would I move? Somewhere not too far from my children. Well, if I had my druthers, I'd go to Washington, D.C.
Why?
Why? Just quality of living, schools.
The schools are good down there?
A couple counties. Howard County got some good schools.
How old are your children?
8 and 13. Elise Monet is 8 and Olivia Grace is 13. They both currently go to Taconic County Charter School. And, you know.
And you said you take them to the library all the time, yeah?
I used to.
Was it only when it was in this location, or?
Yeah, it was pretty much when it was in this location.
Yeah. Is it too hard to get over there?
No, not really. It's just pretty much schedules conflicting.
I see.
Don't want to get into the nature of a working relationship, a co-parenting, but it's usually stuff that, you know, it's understood. It's a compromise, give and takes, communication, and mm-hmm. trying to find times
you
between
don't
work
have
schedules.
To talk about if you don't want to.
Oh, no, it's not that, but it's not really different from anything else, you know.
I'm going to ask you some questions that are standard from one interview to the next so that I can draw these threads. So I wonder, do you have a moment that you are most proud of, either personally or professionally, that you could share?
I have two of them. Having two healthy children in Philadelphia.
That's really sweet.
That's pretty much all I got.
How did you feel when they were born? Like, did you go into the hospital when they were born?
Yeah, I slept them? For the first one, like, the nurses were being weird, but I slept on the hospital floor for like a day. And yeah.
What was it like to see their face for the first time?
I can't really say anything. I kind of just, you know, turned my brain off and just, you know, because there was a whole lot going on that time. Yeah, it was almost complications or what have you. And when we were taking, you know, when you're delivering the baby, something got stuck. She got stuck on her hip or what have you. And I don't know, it's just the doctor just kind of like, you know, looked like she was trying to fix a car or something. The mother says, like, oh, I'm feeling cold. It's like, well, stay awake. You know, little thing. It's a whole lot. So, yeah, but, like, when it was over, it's just, you know, I didn't know what the hell happened yet. You know. I mean, I knew, but it's just, you know. It takes a couple of days. So, that being said, afterwards, and been there for, like, almost a day or two, and sleeping and eating, what have you. I haven't been sleeping and eating. She told me to go home. So, I went home. And it's just like the room wasn't all the way ready. It was spent like the next 26 hours trying to paint that room up right. And, you know, that's what it is.
What did the room look like?
Oh, it was amazing. It's a periwinkle purple lavender, and some spatters of white.
Did it have any artistic flair?
Oh, yeah, it definitely did. Yeah. It definitely did, because these were like quarter buckets of paint left over from the rest of the house. And that's all that was left over. I had a couple rollers. I had one fancy roller that's supposed to do designs or some weird stuff. Mm-hmm. So I just went into it, because it was already prepped, where there was, you know, they did the primer with the sand on in the paint or what have you, but, you know. So I was doing all types of stuff. I was laying foundations. I was dry brushing. You know, I was transitioning colors, complementaries. The ones that I had, like, there were no complementaries in there. They're on the same side of the color wheel. It's like, whatever, just get it done before they get home. You know? And yes. I had, like, maybe 4 to 6 feet of the room not done when they came home. So it was out of gas, but, you Yeah, that was.
But you got it done. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, but that was not all the way done. But that was, you know, like my first taste. It's just like, you know, not really stopping to smell the roses. You keep your feet moving, and you know, because it's on now. The baby's here. Well,
yeah, yeah.
You might as well get used to this. You know, get in your hamster wheel. Enjoy.
Yes, enjoy.
The pain, the toil, the heartache, the sorrow, it's all worth it. It's going to be there. This is not for you. You know,
somebody just said that to me. She's having a baby on August 22nd, and she goes, that's my birthday. And she goes, it's like a sign that it's no longer about me.
Yeah.
Right?
Took your born day.
So, there's two questions I'm on the fence asking you about, either because we're running out of time on this one.
Oh, no,
not
just
this
get
one.
Through it. I'm right here for
you. All right, cool. So, could you share your most fond, earliest memory that you have in your life? And tell me where you are, because I see that you've moved a couple times.
Christmas. At grandma's house in Philadelphia. We were still in New York at the time.
What does it look like in your brain? Like in your mind?
It's just, you know, you see the house, you see the inside of the house, you see everything, but they're kind of superimposed on each other. You're just switching in and out, especially grandma and grandpa. You know.
And then Christmas tree?
Christmas tree, everything. You know,
in the living room or?
Oh, in the living room. Douglas fir. Douglas fir.
Can you smell it?
Yeah, pretty much. You try not to, but that is the fondest, most purest, most realest memory I had. But then, you know, I kind of felt bad after things fell apart and I was living there. It was like, kind of felt guilty. Like, this is what you always wanted, right? This is what you wanted, right? Got sick of your parents, right? You want to live here your whole life, right? This is what you wanted, right?
Why do you feel guilty?
No, but that was...
Kind of like, are you saying like, because that's your fondest memory, you almost secretly wish for that and then you got it?
Well, yeah. But I didn't.
But under like duress?
I didn't secretly wish for it though. It's just, you know, you like it and you enjoy it, but you know, you're raised a certain way.
You like it, you enjoy it, but you don't always want it every year. Like, yet you were basically.
You feel bad about it.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at it the same way. You're going to be grieving for the rest of your life. There's nothing you can do to change it. But, you know, certain things are going to pop up that's out of order, out of context. That particular thought that I did, I was run with that for a minute, it's out of context, it's unhealthy, it's not right. But at the same time, you know.
I don't know. Why is it not right? I think it's...
Because it's self-defeating. It's counterproductive.
You think so? Just to have, like, a fond memory? It's
well, they
not
say
something...
that, like, I don't know what kind of... That, I don't know. It's like a... One of those psychological associations says something mm-hmm. like that. On average, 84% of internal dialogue is negative.
Is that true?
As far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, I would definitely believe that.
Well, yeah, you have to just spend an extra time just trying to filter out thoughts so it doesn't affect your behaviors or ability.
Do you meditate?
No, I don't.
You don't?
No, I don't.
I was trying to meditate the other day. It's so hard.
It's only my own failings, though. I can do it easily. Could have been doing it easily. I could have been meditating for 20 years now. I don't know why. Just not ready yet.
Right, that's true. Your mind has to be in the right place. All right, this is a good question. What advice would you give your teenage self?
What advice would I give my teenage self?
You can say whatever you want.
What would I say to my teenage self? Go work out. Don't go to art school. And pull your shoes up, gird your loins. It's gonna be some shit. That's basically it, you know?
Well, like, when you say work out, do you mean like go to a gym and
yeah,
work out?
Yeah, dude, go ahead, take care of your health, you know, get the blood flowing, you know? Whatever you do, the elliptical, the preacher curls, or heavy lifting, whatever you do. Mm-hmm. Just keep doing that. Other than
why don't go to art school though?
Didn't want to get pigeonholed. I wanted a greater experience with what I'm doing. I don't want to be marginalized by myself.
What art school did you go to?
I actually went to Fisk University. It's a liberal arts college, 1866, like the second oldest historically black college university in America. It's one of the few examples of actually Ivy League, it's basically Ivy League black school, but there's no classification for that, but you know, it's just pretty much the level of quality education they have there and the associations and the relationships they have with other institutions.
Were you an arts major?
Yes, as a Bachelor of Fine Arts. Uh-huh. Bachelor of Fine Arts from there.
And you regret that, or do you?
No, because at the end of the day, I didn't have the grades to get in there. I didn't know what that school was. Mm. I researched it, looked at Forbes Money Magazine, 10 best deals on your stuff. I wanted to go to black school. That was the best deal on the table. I needed to go to a city where there was not that much of a distraction. Philadelphia lost its damn mind that summer I left, and it didn't get it back till almost 2000, from 94 to 2000.
94 to 2000?
With all the killings and stuff that was going inside and around the city, what have you. That was number one, get out of Philadelphia. Number two, go somewhere far enough away where this old stuff with dead relatives, folks you don't get along with, they will be out of your reach and your scope. And if you have to deal with it, you have to deal with it on your own. Number three, I already say go to a city that there's not a whole lot going on at.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's basically it. And I tried to do that. I almost slipped up and went to a school named Bethune-Cookman College, named after the late, great Mary McLeod Bethune-Cookman. I mean, yeah, it was Mary McLeod Bethune, who was, this is a wonderful activist, freedom fighter and pioneer. But the school was on Daytona Beach.
That's where your school was?
No, that school was on
Daytona. Oh, I was going to say.
And so it was just like, I love the history, I love the curriculum. And it was a black woman running, Mary, I wanted that, but I can't go. Why? It's on the beach. Why? You can't handle it. Why? You can't handle anything.
Well, make that me and you both, because if I was on a beach, I wouldn't have been going to school too much.
You almost quit school because of recess back in 10th grade when you moved to Philadelphia. Like,
oh God, come on now.
You wouldn't come back in and stop playing football every lunch period. So, whatever.
All right, one more big question before this time is up, and then we can continue all we want. How would you like to be remembered?
I'm gonna be as honest as I can with you. I don't want to be remembered.
What?
I want to be remembered.
Okay. Why?
Something that you can't control. It's out of your control. I don't even want to broach the subject because, it's like, no. I mean, because it's not really relevant. You can't effectively change. You can't control it. It's almost like junk food, But if I had it my way, I would not want to be remembered. I would like to be the things that I did to be remembered. I would like the people that I effectively worked with and helped, them to be remembered. I don't want to heap praise on myself for just being myself. I don't think that doesn't work for me. So no, I wouldn't really want to be remembered. Not because I think I'm a creep or have a condition or what have you. No, I'm just not into all that grandiose stuff, all that patting on the back. I was like, I want to be remembered as the greatest. The greatest fill in the blank in the universe, galaxy ever. No.
That's an interesting way to interpret the question.
No, it's like, we're good. It's like, you did the right thing when you had the chance. You put your best foot forward, You tried hard enough that you got sick a couple times, And that's all. You're able to put things and other people first and put yourself in context. You're not the whole thing. You're just part of it, a very small part of it. And, it's just, I would like to remember, what the entire rest of the machine or what cog I was in or what I affected the rest of its operation. I would like to see it all in context, but I don't want to be remembered as an island or something wonderful outside myself. No. So, sorry.
There's nothing to apologize for. I actually understand more now what you mean. I like the notion of being remembered for what you affected or the people and the stories of you. And yeah, I get that now. Okay. Before this time, I have 5 minutes on this one. Before that is up, I wanted to ask you if you'd like to share your name and if I can have your permission to put your name up.
Oh, yeah. My name is Cyril Van Landingham.
How do you spell your name?
Cyril. Last name is capital V-A-N space capital L-A-N-D-I-N-G-H-A-M. I am age 41. I turned 42 in September. I'm about to outlive my father in about 4 days. He died at 42. So I've been trying to use my faculties and whatever I can, friends or what have you, advice, just to separate myself from that. You know, because unchecked, it was like a just abject fear.
Like a ticking.
Yeah, no, like, yeah, like that's, abject fear, compounding sense of mortality that is not rooted in anything rational. And it's just really, you know, and it's really hard to shake, and you just have to know it for what it is. It's not BS, it's real, but.
Do you think that the minute you turn 42, you're going to feel a sense of relief?
No. I'm just concerned that it might never go away.
How do you feel about like constructs like that? Like the stories we kind of build in our minds and then we play them out?
Well, it's both sides of the coins. It's a double-edged sword. It's like, what are you really into? Do you like self-deprecation? Do you like defeat? Do you like having an excuse? A self-made excuse?
Right, because that, in a way...
Or do you want, right. You know, or would you like to go ahead and use this as fuel to make sure that certain things don't happen to the next generation or anybody that you know personally? You know, can you use this?
Right, so that 84% internal dialogue that's negative is motivation for a lot of people, right?
Certain people, but the thing is like, if you lie to yourself, you can lie to anybody. And I think that's an issue nowadays, negative or what have you. And it's a lot of people build up false narratives about themselves because they're out of context.
How do you, can you give me an example of that?
Yeah. Yeah. For example, simple one. Oh, man, this sucks, man. Don't nobody like me, man. Simple as that. Little kids do that. It's not like don't nobody like you. They're over there playing with themselves. You want to play? Get up and go play with them. You're sitting up there worrying about what they're going to do. If they don't play, what are they going to do? At least you know now, and it's a good thing. But, you know. Mm-hmm. People always, I mean, I'm not saying people always, but the majority of time, the example being presented are folks going for the lowest common denominator. And I don't know many people that I deal with day to day that like to go, that are productive, that go for the lowest common denominator in any aspect of their lives they can effectively change. So that's what I'm talking about.
That's a good example.
You know, I'm not sitting up here bashing welfare supporters, but it's like in the last week and a half with that type of zero-sum type thinking, these people that, you know, it's just be like, I'm thinking in my mind, it's like, I want to tell them something, it's like, you sound like a welfare supporter.
Gee, that's a real, like, 0 to 60 example, though.
I know.
Don't you think?
I know, but that's kind of like the context I've been thinking of. Because, yeah. You know, the conditions of your life is set up by a certain set of decisions that you made, effectively. You're not going to save the day, what have you, but it's still affected by the decisions you made. And the life you're living right now is the decisions that you made.
Yeah.
The context of whether you live is the decisions you made.
So, since you work with teenagers, maybe you can offer me some advice, because I'm new to all my friends and family having teenagers, and I find that I hear that frequently, the same example that you gave, which was, I'm not going to go play with them because they don't like me. And then how do you know? Well, I don't know.
Yeah, because I don't want to try.
Yes.
The narrative sounds good to me because I'm a victim and I feel good. You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I find that at that stage in the development of the brain, it's almost like they don't even, it's going to stop in 16 seconds.
Okay, but they don't
This is, it'll just, like, hang out while this one keeps recording.
Awesome.
Okay, so I feel like as far as the development of the brain, it's almost like they don't even have that many thoughts going through their mind. Like, I want to be a